Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to day two of our conference. Hopefully everyone's in the right place. This is session 46, the evolution of the feasibility study. My name is Dave Cook. I'll be moderating this morning's session. My background is in parish stewardship and diocesan appeals, and I'm here this year as a proud member of Queen of Apostles Church in Alexandria, Virginia, Diocese of Arlington. Our speaker this morning is a man who needs no introduction, Matt Varela of the Steyr Group, where he has been since 2009. Steyr has done amazing work for the church since 1997, helping parishes, dioceses, and Catholic missions exceed their fundraising and stewardship goals. Before I pass the mic on to Matt, if we could all pray the conference prayer. Loving and gracious God, we ask you to open our hearts to your Son's life and ministry and to answer the call to be his disciples. May our response be rooted in the gospel. May we be ever mindful of the needs of our communities, and may our stewardship flow from a profound sense of gratitude for your many blessings. By the power of the Holy Spirit, empower and inspire us to respond in a way that brings hope to others and reveals the love that comes to us through Jesus Christ. We ask this in his name, who is Lord forever and ever. Amen. In Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen. And quick note before I pass it on to Matt, for any questions that you may have, please save those till the end when I'll pass around the microphone. And Matt, over to you.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for being here. As mentioned, my name is Matt Varela, CEO at the Steyr Group. Just a little background on me. I've been with the firm for 15 years, spent about 7 years running campaigns for Catholic organizations all across the country, parishes, schools, dioceses, transitioned to our management team where I spent a couple of years in a project supervisory role. And then for the last 6.5 years now was president for 5 and then CEO for the last year and a half. On a personal note, married to my wife, Liz. As I say that out loud, it's convenient to be married to your wife, so I didn't probably need to say that. And then I've got 3 young kids at home, not so young anymore now, actually, a 15-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 11-year-old as of yesterday. And so two teenage daughters at home. So if you could pray for me, I would really appreciate it. As far as the presentation this morning, kind of the genesis of it was a management team meeting that we had at the Steyr Group a few years ago where we just did kind of an audit of our study process and, like, are we staying up to date? What changes have taken place over the years? How can we get better? And when we looked at it, we realized that what we are doing today is so dramatically different than what we did 10 years ago. It's not only different, but it's a lot better. Our campaigns are more successful. Our clients were experiencing benefits beyond just a successful campaign from a study. And so we decided that this would be a good topic to share with everybody else as they look down the road, if they have to do future fundraising, the benefits that a study can do for your organization. So how much have feasibility studies evolved for us here at the Steyr Group? So much so that we don't call them feasibility studies anymore. We call them planning studies. There's a feasibility component to it, but most organizations, when I say most, it's 99 out of 100 that contact us, they know they're doing something. It's just a matter of how big of a bite of the apple that they can take. And so for us to then go into that community and test support for a project, that's not all we want to do. We want to see how we can build them up in stewardship and offertory and planned giving and a lot of the other things that we're going to talk about here today. So just a quick overview of what you could expect to hear today. You know, why should you always conduct a study before launching a campaign? I will advocate for that every single time. A lot of times it's not even a separate exercise. It's just that cultivation, education event to lead to successful fundraising. What steps should you take before beginning a study in a campaign? So if you're thinking of doing something 6 months from now, 9 months from now, you know, what can you be doing today to set that up to be successful? And then I think maybe the thing that you will find most interesting is what other benefits can a study to provide to your church, school, or diocese? So just looking at, again, the Steyer Group approach to this, kind of the old way of what we did things, you know, parishes, schools, you did 30 to 50 interviews, if you could, in front of the top donors and leaders. You know, for us now, we try to identify between 100 to 125 of your top potential supporters and leaders with the hopes that somewhere between 80 to 100 will sit down and personally interview it. So it's really sitting down with as many folks as we can. That's great value to engage them, to inform them, to learn from them so that we can customize a campaign plan. And for dioceses in the past, it was, you know, 100 to 150 interviews. Now, we want to interview every pastor. That's not 98% of pastors. It's 100% of pastors. That's critical for us. 200 plus major donors and then other leadership at the diocese and across at parishes and schools. Like, for instance, we did a campaign recently focusing on Catholic education. We wanted to interview not only the superintendent of schools, but the presidents and principals of all the schools across the diocese, because they're going to help shape what it is that we do. And that's, I think, really the hallmark of our approach is customization. You know, don't do cookie cutter fundraising. And the only way that you can do that is to learn from the constituents that you're going to be reaching out to. So for us, it's getting in front of as many people as we can. And then running parallel to all interviews that we do, the grassroots. Invite everybody else to participate. You can uncover a lot of really great information. So we send mail, online, have in-pew surveys, whether it's for a parish, school, or diocese. Our motto is if at any point you're going to ask somebody for $1 for a campaign, ask them for their feedback and their insights. Really, I think it's a stewardship exercise, too, and it's collective. It's that sacrifice of everybody coming together to accomplish something as a community. So that's really important to us. So really, the benefits of a planning study is, again, it's more than just a feasibility study to us. Again, there is that component. We want to tell you how much you can raise, but what else can you accomplish through this exercise? For us, it starts with compelling storytelling. You will never convince me that there's not an more important part of fundraising than telling a good story. It's not necessarily about a new gym that you're going to build or an endowment that you're going to strengthen or debt that you're going to reduce. Yes, those details have to be in there, but we always want to tell the story through the lens of how this is impacting the kids in that gym or the people at that faith community that benefit from the endowment. If you can do that storytelling the right way, it's going to be a much more successful campaign. It's not going to feel transactional. You'll hear me say that word a lot today. We want to avoid transactional fundraising at all costs with all our partnerships. And so during a study, we're learning from people how we can tell that story the right way. We don't want to come in and assume what the story is. We want to first hear from leadership, and then we want to hear from your constituents as to what's going to work best. And for us, that is really the hallmark of successful fundraising. The study also is a great exercise to begin that initial engagement of supporters. If they feel like they are contributing to shape your vision for a campaign, they will give more often and more sacrificially. So that's why we want to invite everybody. That's why we want to sit down with as many people as we can. Again, engagement, education, cultivation, that first step that will set up that future successful fundraising. The study also is a great exercise in giving us the information we need to help you prioritize the goals as we go into fundraising. So a lot of times we'll test really ambitious projects. Maybe a parish that wants to test $10 million in goals. We kind of know going into it their capacity is closer to 5 to 6. It's okay to dream big and share what that story and that long-term vision is. You don't lose credibility if you have to scale things back. You actually gain it because you show that the study exercise wasn't meaningless and you're being responsible stewards. But really, this part of a study is important to us because if a particular goal tests very unfavorably, we might want to change things up in how we roll out a campaign. And this applies not just collectively with everybody's feedback, but individuals. For instance, if we sit down with a major donor during a study and we're testing support for construction of a new parish hall, debt reduction, and an endowment, and the donor says to us, you know, I know that we need that parish hall, but for me, I think endowment and the debt reduction, those are my primary responsibilities. I want to get that taken care of before we invest in some new structure. They gave us a gift by sharing that information to us. So when we go into a campaign, we customize our appeal strategy to that individual donor to say, we want your gifts designated to these things because that's more important to you. And if they feel like they were listened to in that way, they tend to give more sacrificially. That doesn't mean you can't still go for the parish hall for others. Most of the gifts will come in undesignated. But if you listen to people during the study, if they tell you what their priorities are, that will allow for a much more successful campaign. Another great benefit of the study is it uncovers hot button issues that you may not be aware of. I would rather learn that during a study than during the campaign kickoff. If there are any challenges in the community, whether it's related to leadership, how a previous campaign was done, let us learn about that during this study so that we can proactively address it through our communications plan as we get into the campaign itself. So that's an important part of, again, how we want to uncover those things. So, again, it's not a surprise as we begin fundraising. Another benefit of the study is that you are listening. You are kind of shaping the plan for the future of your fundraising effort. And so a lot of times it is the first step in turning some of your critics into strong supporters. One of my favorite stories in my time of doing fundraising, I was doing a project down in Oklahoma City. It was for a school down there. And the second or third interview that I did, a gentleman came in and said, "I do not support this project. This community cannot raise anywhere near the funds that they're looking to. This is the wrong time because of these two or three reasons. And so I'm not supportive of it." So I check the boxes. I have a nice conversation with him. The conversation ends. He walks out. The study continues. It goes well, despite his criticisms. We get into fundraising, and as we're sitting around a table determining who's going to reach out to who is it for appeals, everybody at the leadership team said, "Why don't you take that guy that hates everything?" So that was on my plate, which is wonderful. He agreed to sit down with me for a visit. So, okay, maybe he's had a change of heart. He sits down. He says all of the same things again. "This is the wrong time. I'm not going to give. It's a terrible idea." Okay, check the box. Not interested in giving at this time. We continued to communicate with him. The campaign started soaring. I mean, people just responded to this in a way that was really inspiring. And all of a sudden, one day, as they were getting closer to the campaign goal, a check showed up in the mail from that donor. It was like $2,300, some really weird amount. And so, okay, good, he gave something. The next week, another check came. The next week, another check came. He had a foundation, and he was one of the top supporters, so it was a blow to us that he wasn't giving. That happened for about 4 months, where every month a new check came and they kept getting bigger, to where at the end of the project, he ended up being the second biggest contributor to the entire effort. Why did that happen? Because he felt like he was listened to. He wasn't strong-armed into anything. We were respectful to him about our approach. And then he saw that the community really rallied around it, and he was converted. And at our celebration event, he came up, and the first thing he did is like, "Sorry I put you through that. Mea culpa. I was wrong. You guys did it right." That wouldn't have happened if we didn't have that level of engagement with him. So that's kind of an outlier example, but we do see other examples of that throughout all of our partnerships, where people come in kind of with a grudge or an axe to bear, and they just are, at the end of the day, end up being supportive of it. So again, learning that through the study process before you're actually in fundraising allowed us to do great things at that school. The study is also a great chance to identify a diverse volunteer and leadership team. This isn't something too new. This is something that's been around for a while. But one of the questions that we ask in all of our studies is, how do you want to be involved with this campaign beyond just filling out a pledge card or supporting it financially? You know, as a stewardship firm, we want to value time and talent as much as we are valuing treasure. So we identify people that can serve in all of these various capacities that you see here. And a lot of folks will sign up for, you know, administrative support, phoning nights, helping with events, so that they are giving, so that it really feels like a community coming together and not some back office room trying to raise money. So for us, that's important. We try to have as many people be on our campaign volunteer teams as we can. And this is where it starts, by allowing people to self-identify. So at the end of a study, we're going to have dozens of names, depending on the size of the organization, hundreds of names of people that want to serve in various roles. And then part of our job at the Steyer Group is to recruit them, train them, manage them throughout the entire process. Again, all starts right here. This is also, the study is also a good time for us to introduce the gift pyramid to potential donors. again, doing it early so that they have a sense as to what is needed for this campaign to be successful, again, helps you as you project what you can do going forward. So for a lot of the interviews that we have, we are sharing this, saying this is where we kind of need to be for this campaign to be successful. Where do you see yourself falling on this gift pyramid so that we can fund all of the goals that we have in front of us? So getting that feedback during the study, they're not making a pledge or a commitment at that point, but they're at least getting the understanding that down the road they will be asked for significant support. They can talk to their spouse if he or she's not there, talk to their financial planner so that going into appeals and solicitations, they understand what's to be expected. So again, doing this early in the study is not something that we did 10, 12 years ago. It's something that we're doing now, and it's really benefiting the major gift efforts of our projects. This is also the time when we begin to think about how donors are going to be segmented during a campaign. Now I mentioned how important storytelling is. What we have realized, I think we're a lot better than this today than we were 10, 15 years ago, is that everybody doesn't deserve the same story because they're on different journeys with the organization. So a founding family of a parish needs a different story than somebody that joined the parish 6 months ago. Somebody with kids at the school right now, current parents, deserve a different story than grandparents that don't have any kids in the school but still have an affinity for it. And so this is when we learn about the constituents that we're going to be approaching for support to figure out what story they deserve. So during campaigns, when we send out like appeal letters and the communications plan that we have, a lot of times we'll have 15, 16 different versions of letters going out depending on who it is so that people don't feel like they're getting the same letter and the same story, the same bill of goods that everybody else is in the campaign. So segmenting is really important for us at the Steyer Group. We can't do it unless we have this great participation during studies. And so we ask the questions, what's important to you? What's your relationship to the school or parish? And then that allows us to create that through the campaign. Obviously, there is still the feasibility component to our planning studies. So just identifying what that fundraising capacity is. As I mentioned, a lot of times parishes or schools or even dioceses will test something above what they even know their capacity is, and then we have to scale it back. But that doesn't mean that you can't phase goals. So if a parish has a $10 million goal, we project 6.5 to 7. You know, what can you do at 6.5? We'll call that the celebration goal. And then at 7.5, we're going to have that be the miracle goal. At 8 million, it's the influential goal. At 10 million, it's the holy crap, we did it goal. We won't call it that, but you know, we can call it all of these different things so that you can still aspire and you can still show that we want to do this. This is still part of our vision, but let's celebrate success because a big mistake that some of our clients have done in the past, really against our counsel is, okay, Steyer Group, you said that we can't raise this, but we're still going to set that as the goal. And then what happens? Have a $10 million goal with a $6.5 million projection. They raise 7.5. So internally, we're kind of doing cartwheels, and even the leadership is doing high fives, like, wow, we raised more. The whole community just thinks that we fell $2.5 million short of what it was that we could accomplish. And so that's why studies, to me, are really important, just to not eliminate a lot of the guesswork that goes into what it is that your community can accomplish. Yeah. Yeah, the question is, do we publish what those tiers are? So once we get into the prep phase of the campaign, we determine what those tiers are, and then yes, that is communicated to people so that they can see that we can at least celebrate this first level of success. And associated with those tiers are the specific projects that are going to be funded at the $6.5 million if that's the first goal. So absolutely, that is promoted. Yes? No, you're fine. It's rare, and what usually happens is an organization will come to us and say, our community is studied out, meaning that there have been quite a few done over the years, and maybe it didn't materialize the way that they thought. So the idea of doing another study really not a good idea. And so in those instances, what we'll try to encourage them to do is have us do, we won't call it a study. We'll build in kind of an assessment on the front end. It's a little bit, you know, just changing the wording a little bit, but having some sort of engagement. It's usually not at the level that I described earlier because of the reasons that this organization doesn't want to do it, but it is rare. I always try to talk them out of it. And the way I try to talk them out of it is this study is different than what you've done in the past because it's specific to this campaign. Don't even view it as a separate exercise. It is really a part. It's setting the table for what you want to do with fundraising. So it is rare, but when it does come up, I try to talk them out of it. If I can't talk them out of it, then we try to just change things up so we can at least get some of that feedback to do all of this customization. All right. Thank you. So, again, fundraising capacity, it's great to know before you jump into fundraising. This is also a good opportunity to identify, research other opportunities, kind of expanding the outreach that might exist beyond your database. And so we do a lot of research on what – so at the Steyer Group, we have an in-house foundation research and grant writing department. Their job is to identify, research, submit applications to charitable foundations that have historically supported Catholic causes, Catholic education, et cetera. So we start during the study, and we identify all of the foundations locally, regionally, sometimes nationally, that's a little bit more difficult, that could be good fits for this organization. That starts during the study. Local corporations sometimes have matching gift opportunities where an employee that gives $2,500 could get it matched. Let's identify that during the study, promote it to see what other types of gift opportunities may exist there. Vendors, sending just a survey to a vendor to say, hey, listen, we invest a lot in you every year. Can you invest something in us? Either from your charitable budget, or if you don't have one of those, maybe it's from your marketing budget because we'll promote the fact that you're supporting this school or this parish. And then other, sometimes if we're doing a school campaign, we will interview somebody at the diocese and they will say, we know of some people here that are very strongly supportive of what the goals of the school are. So they will share that information with us. So if we could learn this during the study, it'll allow us to more intentionally create appeal and communication strategies for them as we get into the campaign. The study also kind of sets the table for the relationship mapping that we want to do during a campaign. Obviously, we want to identify who are the lead potential donors, but just as important, we want to figure out who knows those donors best, so who can be involved in our team approach, our cultivation strategy leading up to an appeal during a campaign. So that's one of the questions that we ask in all our studies is, who else do you know that might not be on our radar that could be lead supporters to this effort? Who do you know that could be lead supporters that everybody probably knows? When those names bubble to the top, that is meaningful. And then if there's anybody on these foundation boards that we are going to be researching, we'll promote those foundation boards to the leadership. And if there's any connection to somebody either at the parish, at the school, at the diocese where we can get an introduction, we have a much better chance at foundation success if we're able to all of a sudden become an agenda item on one of their meetings because of that introduction, as opposed to sending a letter saying, here's who we are. You've never heard of us until now. Here's what you'd like you to fund. That's a little bit more of a challenge. So that to us is an important part of this. And again, it starts during the study. We also, as a part of our studies, we want you to see other tangible benefits of your partnership with our firm, other than just raising a lot of money towards the campaign. And again, the way that we set the table is it starts in the study. And so we spend a lot of time talking about and seeking out planned gifts. We have a planned giving specialist at the Steyer Group that work with our managers and with our service team to make sure that it is a prominent part of our communications. For us, it starts in the study. We ask everybody who participates, have you remembered the organization in your estate plans? We'll get some good information there that they may not have been aware of, which is great, and we can follow up on that during the campaign. But then the follow-up question to those that say no is, would you like to receive more information about how to make a planned gift? They will provide their feedback. Almost always surprised at the number of people that say yes. If they're presented the opportunity, they're interested in learning more about it. And then what do we do with that? During the campaign, there will be opportunities for us based on the individual feedback that we get to have dual asks of some supporters. Meaning, would you support these projects that we are promoting right here in front of us for this campaign? And can we formalize your legacy support to the parish or school? And if you'd be so kind, can we promote that? Not the amount, we'll keep that confidential, but the fact that you did it in the hopes that it'll motivate others. So an expected outcome of all of our partnerships is a much stronger plan giving program. It's through the promotion of it, but then it's through the individual asks that we do through our campaigns. And again, we learn about this because they self-identify during the study. So for us, it's an important part of all of our engagements. And a question that always comes up, well, how do you count that on the campaign thermometer? We don't. It's a separate kind of line item. It's another positive result of the campaign in that we strengthen your planned giving program. But, you know, if you have a $10 million goal to build a parish hall, you can't really put $2 million in legacy gifts on there because you might not realize those for a few decades. So it's just a separate line item that we want to promote to everybody. We at the Steyer Group, as a part of our partnerships, we want you to see an increase in offertory, annual appeals, annual giving. If it goes the other way, we did it wrong because that is not something that can happen. As a stewardship firm, we are very clear in our communications that a gift to this campaign has to be extraordinary, sacrificial, above and beyond what you're giving to Offertory, what you're giving to all of the events that they have going on, what you're giving to the diocesan annual appeal. If we don't promote it that way, we're doing a disservice to our clients. So for us, we want all of our clients to kind of embrace the challenge of being bold about how you request support for a campaign. So for us, we always suggest don't suspend any fundraising that you have going on. Those things have to continue because when we're gone, when the campaign is over, if those events come back, they're going to struggle because people were used to it. They were budgeting for it. And so if it goes away and comes back, it's not going to do as well. Our job at the Steyer Group is to make sure that the communications for these appeals and for these other events are complemented by what we're doing and vice versa and not competitive with it. And so we, a lot of times, will help draft the communications for the appeal, for the annual gala that a school might have so that, again, it's just a good synergy between what we're doing with the campaign. So for us, that's important. That said, we want to be sensitive to timing and messaging. And so, you know, you never want to have a campaign kickoff on one Saturday and then your signature fundraising gala the next. So we're intentional about making sure that that makes sense of how that's all lined up. So, and then our job is to communicate during a campaign. And again, during the study is when we start setting the table for this, is how is this different from annual support? How is this campaign different from that? So that people understand that both are necessary. Yes, we need the new parish hall, but we have to keep the lights on too. And so we have to do both kind of simultaneously complementary. And then really for us, we are interested in identifying, you know, donors that haven't given before. So I guess they're not called donors yet, but identifying who could be that first time donor and really we focus on participation in a way that for most of our projects, we will have a participation thermometer right next to the campaign funds raised thermometer because it's kind of the stewardship mentality of everybody, this community coming together, equal sacrifice. Sometimes a family that gives $20 a month to a campaign sacrifices more than somebody who writes a $250,000 check. And so we want everybody to feel like they were a part of this in a meaningful way. And so that is something that we look to identify during the study and then embrace that challenge of reaching out to them during the campaign. And really the proof is in the statistics that we track at the Steyer Group. When we look at annual offertory, the year that a campaign is conducted, on average, the parish's offertory increases by 2%. There are, candidly, a few examples of some dips as people get used to budgeting for a new gift. Those are outliers, I would say, too. But overall, it is a 2% increase. But then you see the numbers go up year after year. Why do I think this happens? Number one, it's how we go about asking people for support. I think we're good storytellers. People like to be involved with winning projects. Giving begets more giving. Success breeds additional success. If they see that leadership is forward thinking and they have a vision for what they want to have accomplished at the parish, then, you know, they'll give to the campaign, but then these other benefits will also, result for the organization. Also during a study, and sometimes this is even before the study starts, that's kind of a unique thing about our partnerships is, you know, somebody might contact me today, say we'd like to start a study in January. And then I think a lot of firms are like, okay, well, we'll talk to you in January to get that going. That's not us. We will work with you in October, November, December to get it all set up to be successful. And part of that is an assessment of your kind of development capabilities, making sure that you're set up to be able to run this so that you can be successful now with us on site working with you, but then also during pledge redemption and in the years that follow. So really, this is an opportunity to kind of invest in you if we see some opportunity, if we see some challenges there. And then we want you to implement best practices. Again, this is our job to set you up to do this, but making sure that acknowledgements go out, reminder letters happen, year-end tax statements, database management, pledge redemption processes. We're talking about all of this before the study begins to make sure that it can happen as we get into the fundraising and beyond. Another great benefit of the, I think this is something that's really helped our projects, is learning about the communication preferences of your donors. There are so many ways to get messages in front of people these days, and the preferences vary. And so I don't want to guess what's going to work in a particular community. I want to ask the question and customize a communication strategy around that. So is it direct mail? Some people still like going out to their mailbox. Is it on their phone? Is it short videos? Is it via the bulletin announcement? You know, we ask questions. How do you want to be communicated with? And based on that feedback, again, both individually and as a community, develop a communication strategy that's going to serve that particular organization best. And that can carry forward beyond just what the campaign is all about. It's just with all of the other development activities and communication strategies, this is good information to have. And again, we learn about that during the study. Not mentioned here, but another question that we ask in our studies is, how do you want to be approached for support? The days of knocking on people's doors while they're eating dinner to see if they want to talk about a campaign, those are far gone. I didn't like those days. Now it's really learning, what would you prefer? Do you want to meet after mass? Do you want to have a small group event? Do you want to just be sent a pledge card? There are so many different ways that you can do that solicitation. I don't want to guess. I want to come up with the best strategy based on what people tell us. And it varies community to community. So we'll have a campaign, you know, in Philadelphia that looks vastly different than one down in Houston, just because those communities told us that please approach us in these particular ways and please communicate with us in these particular ways. And they don't look alike at all, but it's respecting who they are. So I think at the end of the day, one of the reasons that we at the Steyer Group have great pledge redemption rates is because of these questions that we ask during the study. But those questions, how do you want to be communicated with? How do you want to be approached for support? How do you prioritize the goals? When a donor feels like they were listened to and just weren't sent some scripted letter saying support this campaign, here's a pledge card, they honor their commitments more and they're more invested. So making a more personal experience as opposed to, here's that word again, transactional, is very important for us. Another thing that we want to accomplish through our studies is trying to engage a new generation of donors and leaders. It's why we ask the question, how do you want to be involved with this beyond just writing a check? And so I hear this everywhere I go. It's the same people serving on the same committees all the time. When's the younger generation going to come in? So for us, we want to identify who that younger generation is and not, you know, fully pass the baton from those that still want to be involved, but at least begin to develop kind of the future of who's going to be the leaders at that parish or at that school. A lot of times we'll implement like volunteer or leadership mentorship programs where somebody that's like a little bit on the fence about whether or not they want to serve in a role for a campaign, they'll be matched up with somebody that's been there for 40 years and say, here, let me kind of walk you through this so that you can help and kind of replace me down the road when I don't want to do this anymore. And so for us, that's another great benefit of a study is being able to identify those individuals. So that's kind of the evolution of the study and how much more comprehensive it is than it was for us 10, 15 years ago. And again, I think our clients are benefiting from it because they're raising more money. They're seeing all these other tangible outcomes that are great for their communities. So now I want to transition quickly to some of the recommendations that we have for organizations before they start a study or a campaign. So if you're looking to do something 3, 6, 9, 12 months from now, here's what I would recommend. First is involve lay leaders and high capacity donors in your planning process. So think about who are the two or three families that need to be invested in this for it to be successful because they were blessed with that type of capacity. If you could form some sort of visioning committee where they have a meeting or two with leadership there at the parish or school or diocese where they can lend their insights, where they can lend their credibility in a lot of ways to the project, down the road, when it's time for them to be asked for support, they are going to give more because they are invested now in it with their names, with their reputations, with their opinions. Now they don't want to see it fail. They were a part of planning for it. So it's not just for, on the money side of things. They're going to, because they're successful, they're probably going to give you good ideas too. So that is one thing that I encourage a lot of folks to do. Number two, establish consensus from leadership about the goals that you want to raise funds for before you start the project. Those are the nightmare partnerships for us when we go into a community and 60% of a board is in favor of it and the other 40% is out complaining about why the 60% went out. If we have to go to that 40% and say, we respect what your opinions are, however, this is the direction that Father and the bishop or whoever, the president, principal decided to go, we understand that you're not on the same page, but you can't poison the well for us. That's good for nobody. This is still going to be very important. So figuring out how to do that is, I wish I had the answer to that, because I'd probably be presenting somewhere else and making a lot more money. But, for us, it's really important to have those conversations before you jump into the study or the campaign. So there's not that vocal minority out there kind of ruining things for what you want to accomplish. This is not anything revolutionary, but be enthusiastic about presenting the future for the about the vision for the future of your organization. What I mean by this is if people have a mindset sitting around a table planning for a campaign as, oh, we have to do a campaign, as opposed to we get to do a campaign because it's going to be so great for our organization. The latter way is the way to go because if leadership is not enthusiastic about it, the people in the pews are going to see that. And why would they get enthusiastic about it? So just go into this thinking that, okay, this is wonderful for us and we're embracing it. Number four, be brave. I think that, again, I think churches and schools, they have an advantage in that they tend to be towards the top of the priority list for charitable giving for most individuals. So I think it's okay if you're trying to do a transformational campaign that, you know, one that you're not going to do for another 5, 10, 15 years, don't be afraid to ask if your organization can be the primary charitable priority for them over the next few years. Again, that's not taking away from a diocesan annual appeal or some of those other things that I mentioned earlier, you know, as far as a stewardship firm goes, but it's important that you are brave in saying, please invest in us now. And then, you know, the other projects down the road, I think, will still be there. That's tough sometimes because people want to give to a variety of things, but that's why I'm saying be brave and say, for now, this is what we need to accomplish. And it's going to be tough unless people really do sacrifice. Number five, don't begin a study if you aren't ready to go immediately into a campaign. We have data to support this. Organizations that do a study and then say, let's take the summer to kind of refine things and then we'll go back and start a campaign, they raise less money. The energy, the awareness, the momentum, the enthusiasm will all be at all-time highs at the end of a study. People are going to know what's next. You know, so many people participated. They said they wanted to be lead donors. They said they wanted to be volunteers, leaders, etc. If you wait 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, whatever that is, when you reach out to them and say, hey, remember when you said that you'd be a leader on the campaign? Nope. That's essentially a lot of times what they say. But if you can run immediately into a campaign from a study, that's one of the first things we do in week one or week two of the campaign. Again, the study just ended 2 weeks ago, is send that letter out, that planning study results letter out, and then thanking the people that said they wanted to serve in leadership roles and that we would be following up and kind of setting what that calendar looks like. So again, we don't want to lose out on that energy and awareness. So don't start that study unless you're ready to go immediately into a campaign. Number six, never in a study present an either or case statement. What do I mean by that? So we know we need a new school, and so let's do a study, a feasibility study or a planning study for a campaign to determine whether we should build new, because we've got this land that we could acquire a mile away, or renovate the existing structure. Let the study dictate that. That's a terrible idea. You're in leadership positions for a reason to make the determination as to what's best for your organization. If you do that either-or situation and it comes back 70-30 in favor of building new, you just alienated 30% of your audience. Instead, as a leadership team, confidently determine what it is that's best. You can do some sort of assessment or town halls before you get into a campaign planning study to determine, you know, what the constituents and donors are thinking, but don't do it during a planning study for a campaign. That is a bad idea. Commit, this isn't revolutionary either, but commit to transparency and strong ongoing communications, not just on the front end and not just during the campaign, but this is the biggest complaint I get is during the pledge redemption period, people made this commitment, something sacrificial to them, and then they don't hear about where their funds are going. Maybe they see a building going up, but they're not hearing about it. Donors want to hear about where their investments are going, where their sacrifices are going, which leads to maybe the most important one, which is you can't say thank you enough. I've never run across somebody who said, could you please stop expressing gratitude for my sacrificial gift? That's never happened. And so making sure that they get that initial thank you letter, that in all of the follow-up communications, thank you again. Major donors, especially that one-on-one attention, I think is really important. So for us, it's something that we emphasize during the campaign, and then in our pledge redemption kind of roadmap, we provide all the templates for that as well. So those are some of the steps that I think every organization can consider before jumping into a study and campaign. So that's my presentation. Again, so thankful to be here today. Now I'd like to open it up to any questions about either anything I've discussed or really anything in the world of fundraising and development. Okay, thank you. Oh, darn it.
Thanks, Matt. So you mentioned the segmentation of the letters and that there's maybe 16 different segments. Can you provide an example of what those segments would look like and how they're different?
Yeah, so I'll just as an example, a school campaign, because we tend to have more segments for school campaigns than parish campaigns. So we would have one version of a cover letter for current parents and an appeal strategy and a case for support. We would have one version for past parents. We would have one for friends of the school. We would have one for past grandparents. We would have one for current grandparents. We would have one for alumni. And then each of the alumni decades would might be something different, where you'd have an alumni captain sign it with kind of a personalized message to, you know, that particular class or that particular era of alumni. We would have one to foundations. We would have one to vendors. We would have one to, you know, local corporations that have matching gift programs. One to just major donors, you know, that have a little bit of a higher ask. Those are segmented that way. So those, that adds up really quickly. And so those are some of the examples that we use.
Hey, so I had heard you saying you're increasing your interviews and your amount of you know, field work as you do the feasibility study, and I'm accustomed to telling clients that the feasibility study is the short one. Have you seen an increase in the amount of time that you need to tell clients that you're going to spend on the feasibility study with these changes?
We do need a little bit longer of a runway period to jump into week one of interviews. So on average, if a parish or school contacts us, what I'm telling them is we need like a 6-week runway period. That is subject to change. We'll have a first working meeting with the leadership team, and we at the Steyer Group need to see certain boxes that have been checked, even for us to recommend that you're ready to go forward with it. If all the boxes are checked, it'll take 5 or 6 weeks. If there's some where you don't have enough specificity on the goals, right now it's kind of abstract. If you have vague details, that's an oxymoron, but if you have vague details in a study fact sheet, you're going to get vague feedback from your constituents, and the study process isn't giving you what you need it to give you. And so if we see that vagueness during that runway period, we're going to say we got to get more specificity there. So it's about 5 to 6 weeks. We've had some, I'll cite kind of another outlier example. We're working with a parish down outside of Dallas. I think it's the third largest parish in the country. 60,000 people, if you can imagine, at one parish. I still don't get it. But, yeah, so they had like a 9-month runway period, because we interviewed all of the leaders of their ministries to see what they could lend to the goals that they wanted to develop for this campaign. And we were in meetings with the architects just to provide our feedback through that fundraising campaign lens. And so, again, we don't want our partnerships to have 9-month runway periods. That's an outlier. But if it's necessary, we will make that investment. And we don't charge for that. That's just us setting the study up for success. Did that answer your question? Okay, good.
I'm just curious on how people are giving their gifts and how that's changing. Particularly, are you seeing a lot of movement towards DAF giving, and how does that affect things and how they come in?
Yeah, obviously a lot of electronic recurring giving is what we're trying to emphasize. And so it's a lot less checks, obviously, than you can imagine, than there used to be. But there's also creative ways that people are giving, whether it's from like donor advised funds. Some people will take out insurance policies that the beneficiary, that's their gift, is they're paying the premiums on an insurance policy. And then the organization gets the results of that. That's sad because you're talking about, you know, somebody passing away, but it is a really smart tax benefit for them, to do it that way. And so during the campaign, we provide all of the different ways that people can support a project. And then, again, based on what we learned from them during the study, when we approached them, we said, we understand this is how you'd like to give. Here's kind of how that could play out. But it's a lot more recurring giving, which I think is a benefit to our clients because they can just expect that to roll in and there's less follow-up with donors about why their check hasn't come in the mail yet.
So I've noticed coming out of COVID, for the past 2 years now, more parishes have been reaching out saying, I want to run a capital campaign. I want to do increased offertory, more than usual. So internally, we like to say, okay, well, what are you looking to do? And, you know, we don't necessarily guide them to do a feasibility study. We typically have an internal threshold of 3 times. If it's over 3 times your ordinary income, then we suggest doing a feasibility study. Is that a good practice to have, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, if it's just about trying to raise money, if that's the singular thing that you're looking at, I don't have an issue with that. However, I think campaigns are much bigger opportunities than that for everything that I described today. Like, I would encourage those parishes to consider doing a study because you can accomplish so much more than just raising funds towards a project. I think that you can't customize in the way that I'm talking about if you just say, well, they can raise 3 times, go start asking people for money. You need to ask people how they prioritize things, if they'll serve in those leadership roles. Again, kind of as a stewardship firm, we want to emphasize those things as well. So it wouldn't be the way I would do it. However, if there's, smaller parishes, sometimes it makes a little bit more sense just because of resources. That's the one thing about our model. You know, if a parish wants to raise $400,000, we're not the right fit for them because, we're just cost prohibitive. But for, you know, parishes that want to raise $1 million or more, it does make sense to go with us. So, I think you're missing out on opportunities by doing it that way. But, you know, by necessity, I understand it's probably required on occasion. It's rare for us to set like a dollar figure goal for increased offertory as a part of what we're doing for a study and a campaign. It's not rare for us to track how offertory is increased through our commitment to promoting that as a part of this effort. So we are promoting that, which is we want not only to build this new building, but we want offertory to be increased alongside that. And so it's through our communications. It's not direct in your face. It's kind of a little bit more subtle. One thing, you know, as a stewardship firm, we don't say the word stewardship a lot. Otherwise, it loses its meaning. It's really a lot more subtle than that in all of our communications. Same with offertory enhancement. We're showing the vision. We're showing how this campaign is going to get you there. Right alongside that, offertory needs to increase for us to continue to fund everything else that we're doing. So it does organically happen, as shown by the statistics that I cited, but it's not something that's like a separate service that we're really pushing through our projects. Does that make sense? Okay.
Well, let's give Matt a big round of applause.
Thank you.
I'm sure Matt will stick around for a few minutes to answer any other questions.
Absolutely.
And perhaps the presentation as well can be put on the Whova app.
Yeah, of course.
So everyone can take a look at that. And then just a reminder, please fill out a survey on the app from today's presentation. It'll help the ICSC improve and grow and provide great presentations like Matt provided this morning. Thank you very much. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, everybody.